Prabhupada's trying to encourage his godbrothers. They're sannyasis, and we have so many brahmacharis, they have so much experience, and we'll give you buses, you can manage parties, but you have to distribute my books, and you have to work with the GBC. So I thought that was quite interesting, because that right there is a flavor or a mood, that I've created the structure that will spread Krishna consciousness, so work with us, but these are the books, and this is how the organization works. So I'll stop and let you.
Yeah, that rings a bell now.
I'm just going to make noise when I drink.
Okay.
Because it's hot.
We need sound effects. Both Shruti Kirti and Hari Sariputta report that in their on their watch, on their stints as Prabhupada's personal servants, Prabhupada visited with Sridhar Maharaj. With Shruti Kirti, it was in Navadvipa. And on this occasion, Shruti Kirti reports that Prabhupada was, this is 73, so the devotees have caught on to distributing books. So Prabhupada is sharing with His Holiness Bhakti Rakshak Sridhar Maharaj, who was practically the senior sannyasi in the Gaudiya Math, if you know anything about the Gaudiya mission. He was telling Sridhar Maharaj how these Western boys and girls are serving so nicely, and they're distributing so many books, and people are paying $10 for a book. Isn't that right, Shruti Kirti? And $10, 10 USD, was a lot of money in the 70s to pay for a book. And then Prabhupada was saying, why don't you come and join us? You are so qualified. And this is not one man's work. It's too much. I can't keep up with it. So please join us. And interestingly, on one occasion, I was hearing a recording actually, Shruti Kirti and Harishara people were together, just like this, God brothers sharing with devotees in England. And so when Shruti Kirti was saying this, that they were in Navadvipa, and then Harishari comes in and says, well, this is amazing, because almost the same scenario. In 1976, I was with Prabhupada in Mayapur, and this time, Prabhupada's godbrother Sridhar Maharaj came to Prabhupada's rooms in Mayapur, and it was the same thing, 1976. Maharaj, this is not one man's work. Will you please come? You can train these, you're so qualified, you can just train these people however you want. I know you'll train them nicely. And then Harishari says that Sridhar Maharaj looked a little wistful. Wistful means like he realized that because of Prabhupada's success, because Sridhar Maharaj at that time, you know what he said? Actually, you're the real Acharya. It was very nice. You're the real Acharya. You know, we thought that when Mahaprabhu said, Priti Vitayachayata Nagara Nigram, in as many towns and villages as there are on the surface of the earth, my holy name will be preached. We thought it was just some poetic expression, because the experience of those three Gaudiya Math sannyasis that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had sent to Europe was not very fruitful. They thought, how are these people, they can't even imagine following the four regulative principles. So how is it ever going to go to every town and village? But you, Maharaj, have done this. So actually, you are the real Acharya. So when Prabhupada invited him to come join them, Harishari said later to Prabhupada, he looked rather wistful, meaning that he realized at that point that perhaps if I had, come earlier with going to the West, there would have been some effect. And then Prabhupada revealed to Hari Shari that this whole idea of trying to engage Sridhar Maharaj in outreach, in preaching, comes from the 1930s, Prabhupada said, when Guru Maharaj told me, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta told me, that Sridhar Maharaj is so qualified, but he doesn't get out enough to preach. So you please drag him. You drag him out. So it was like Prabhupada had this standing order from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. He was always trying to encourage Sridhar Maharaj. So in 76, when Prabhupada invited again, just like 73 and invited, 76, Sridhar Maharaj, he looked wistful. He didn't say yes, he didn't say no. And then, after some time, he went back to Namadweep. And then, Prabhupada called a meeting of the leaders and into his room, and he said, I have just invited Sridhar Maharaj to join us in ISKCON. But if he doesn't say anything about my invitation, you don't say anything to him. Because actually, I know that if a lot of these Gaudiya Math people come in, there will be a big disturbance because they will have a different mood. They will have a different, they will have a different emphasis, a different accent, and it will be, so don't say anything. In other words, Prabhupada felt obliged to encourage Maharaj to preach, Sridhar Maharaj, but he really could see that it would be big trouble if they came in. So it was a mixed relationship. On the one hand, Srila Prabhupada, both in one purport at least I know of in Bhagavatam, and in one letter to Brahmananda Swami at the time, was embracing his godbrothers as fellow Vaishnavs, and although we're not working cooperatively since the time of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, we're all in our own way spreading Krishna consciousness. So he didn't want us to get a negative attitude toward them, but it's also very clear he didn't want us to take guidance from them about how to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world, because really it was only our Prabhupada, by dint of his unique surrender to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's order, he was uniquely empowered to know how to do it, how to make Bideshis, foreigners, international folks, Vaishnavs, whereas the others did not. So it was a rather mixed relationship. I'd just like to say one more thing about mood. There's one purport, Canto 4, Chapter 28, it's King Paranjan becomes a woman in his next life. Text 51, and Prabhupada says in the purport to that verse that if you give your life to the mission of the spiritual master, that this is tantamount, is amounts to, it's the same, equal to, seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. So Prabhupada's mood is very much mission-oriented, and as was Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, who was very fond of saying, don't try to see God, but act in such a way that God will see you. He'll be pleased. It's a descending process, which is just the opposite. This mood of giving your life to a preaching mission, it's just the opposite of what you find amongst, not authentic, but, you know, so-called, say, Radhakund Babajis, for example. If you go to Radhakund, they will tell you the highest thing is to cultivate, you know, your siddha deha, these esoteric aspects of bhakti, and preaching is really external. But what does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita? For one who explains this supreme secret to the devotees, devotional service is guaranteed. And at the end he comes back to me, there is no servant in this world more dear to me than he. You know, do they have this in South Africa? Where, I think I mentioned this in Malaysia, where if there's a missing child or even a missing dog or cat, you know, you post a notice on the, do people do that? If you've seen this dog or cat, or if you've seen my runaway child, please call this number, you know. And if you do call the number, if you provide valuable information and it leads to the reuniting of the love of the beloveds, then that person is so grateful. So when we are determined to come to pure devotional service and bring people, as many people as we can, back to Krishna, Krishna is so grateful for that. So that's the mood. The mood is to give your life to the mission. Don't try to, you know, ascend to the esoteric aspects of bhakti. Just let Krishna be pleased with you and reveal himself to you. So, what else? Anything on that?
Well, I'm thinking that maybe we can discuss some of the moods in ISKCON that were not Prabhupada's mood that he had to correct. Mm. Some things that... See, ISKCON, it's like a... when you plant a tree, you put a fence around it. I don't know if you do that here, but in India they do. There's so many animals, so you have to protect it. So Prabhupada was putting a fence around ISKCON. But then sometimes somebody would jump over the fence and something would come in and then he'd have to get it out. And as young devotees, when something foreign would come in, we didn't know it was foreign. And a lot of foreign things came in, which is Sureshwar Prabhu was saying, is someone has said something, some Vaishnavas had said something to try to correct what we were doing in ISKCON, or to point out that what we're doing is not right, or it's not the highest, or we're not qualified enough to do what we're doing, something that Prabhupada hadn't taught us. And so then it would come to Prabhupada and we'd say, what about this? And he would have to correct. I think maybe we could talk about some of those things that came. Some were very little and some were very big. Some were just fads, devotees wearing, so I don't know, certain kinds of necklaces, that were, Tulsi and gold or something. There were fads of Rolex watches and Seiko watches, little things like that. And then there were philosophical misunderstandings, even potential factions. And some of those moods were also generated by our own devotees. They didn't come from outside. They just came from misunderstanding or putting two and two together and coming up with five. But it's not being good with the math. Well, Prabhupada said this, he said that, therefore this. And that this was not what he wanted. So I was thinking maybe we could talk about some of those things, because that will make this discussion more clear. And then bring it to the current context of what some of those things may be today. And then that, I think, will give you more of an understanding of the flavor or the mood or the context which Prabhupada created and wanted to preserve. Because we need to know this if we're going to preserve it, because if you don't know what's wrong, you won't react. Right? Like maybe there's some serious disease going around and you don't know the symptoms. All you have is a little cough, but actually you might have Ebola or something. You don't know that. You just think it's a cough. Prabhu, are you going to die anyway, today or tomorrow? Does it matter?
I'm ready.
Krishna, can I die just after I finish the seminar? People are waiting for it. So, you know what I'm saying? Then if you know, this could be a symptom of something serious, then you can address it in your own life and help others. So would you like to start with something you can think of that Prabhupada had to let us know and was not right and sweep out of the movement? Or wash down the toilet, however it was?
Let me just say the punchline of the last thing I was about giving yourself to the mission. At the end of this purport, 4:28:51, Prabhupada ends with a real heavy statement. He says, instead of being eager to see Krishna in some bush of Vrindavan, one should rather give his life to the mission of the spiritual master, and he very easily will see Krishna face to face, eye to eye.
Okay, so that's what. So then why don't you just explain the misconception that Prabhupada was dealing with in that purport?
That somehow it's the same disease. Our diseases, we think we have some identity separate from serving the spiritual master, serving. We're going to somehow carve out something on our own. It's the ascending disease. But I just thought of something, Mahaprabhu, since we're approaching the Jnana Trayodashi on Sunday, Do you remember the Nityananda cult?
No.
Oh, okay.
Well, remind me. Maybe
there was a fad in the mid-70s. And I say this as we're approaching Lord Nityananda's appearance day, which is one of our sacred days. But there was a fad that was coming from our St. Louis temple.
From Oquimla?
And wherever they would go, wherever these devotees would go, and it was coming from the temple president, they would just corral the devotees wherever they would go at festivals. And, Prabhu, why aren't you focusing on Lord Nityananda? You know, without the mercy of Lord Nityananda, our lives are useless. And it would just go on and on and on. Because you can find that in Prabhupada's instructions and songs by Narottam Das Thakur. And it got to be so, overbearing that T.P. started writing Prabhupada about this kind of Nityananda lopsided, out of balance focus. Or is it? Or what's going on here? Why are we missing something here? So, and then finally, the temple president, who was propagating this exclusive Nityananda focus, wrote Prabhupada because he wasn't getting much response, and he was writing to complain to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was hearing also that, this person is just exclusively focusing on Lord Nityananda. So the gist of Prabhupada's response was, first he said, this is very nice that you're appreciating Lord Nityananda, but if you want to emphasize anyone, emphasize your spiritual master, which everybody could relate to, because everybody's worshipping Prabhupada's Murti, studying his books, engaging in his mission. That was the common, and that is still the pivot of our lives, the Founder-Acharya. So that was an example of somebody focusing on an aspect of Prabhupada's instructions and making it as everything. And that's typical neophyte, right? I'm doing something, and I'm so excited about it, I don't understand why everybody isn't as excited as me about distributing books, about protecting cows, about educating Gurukula, you name it, farms, It's really only in this well-rounded sangha of serious and sincere devotees who are reasonable, intelligent, and balanced that Prabhupada's full mercy emerges. Nobody has all of Prabhupada. Any guru or god family is accessing an aspect of Prabhupada. But in that appreciative, well-rounded sangha of devotees, then all of Prabhupada's mercy manifests. So it's a very balanced mood. I'll just end with one little anecdote. I was traveling with Satsvara Maharaj in 1972. We were operating out of Dallas, Texas, which was the first Gurukula, and we were distributing back to Godheads, sending remittances to the BBT and to the Dallas Gurukula, which Maharaj was supervising. And Prabhupada was writing a lot of letters at the time about the importance of book distribution. And so Satsuru Maharaj wrote Prabhupada a letter saying, maybe we should just exclusively just do book distribution and I shouldn't even be involved in the Gurukula. So Prabhupada wrote a letter back saying, why do you say this one thing is important, not the other thing? Krishna's head is important, Krishna's tail is important, Prabhupada said. So don't get your head bent out of shape because something's being emphasized. Everything's important. Just like Prabhupada gave an example, if I stub my toe, if I cut my toe, am I going to disdain my toe? Oh, you're just my toe. You're just a shudra. You're just the lower part of my body. No, I'm going to marshal all of my intelligence and all of my energy to get that toe fixed. Otherwise, I'll just be a talking head and I can't go anywhere because I'm crippled, right? So it's really all about balance. That was a big part of Prabhupada's Buddha, being balanced, reasonable. Sometimes he would say 90% of Krishna consciousness is common sense.
And if you don't have any common sense, ask someone who does.
Yes, famous letter.
In relation to the purport that Srisha Prabhu was talking about, there is a Prabhupada needed to say that because there are some who will stress that by surrendering fully to the Guru and his preaching mission, it's not sufficient. Look at it. If you want to see Krishna in this life, there's a process to do it. And it's not just preaching, but you have to do an internal cultivation and go through, you know, certain process. So that's something you hear quite frequently outside of ISKCON. Inside, not so much. And if anyone feels that way, they keep it to themselves because they still understand that the preaching mission is everything. So there's a story where there was so much difficulty in acquiring the Bombay property that Timokrishna Maharaj, who was GVC, went to Prabhupada's room and he said, "Prabhupada, I'm so disturbed I can't even chant my rounds." And Prabhupada said, "Me too. I can't chant either, Prabhupada." There was such a disturbance. And Timokrishna Maharaj was, you know, saying, "I have so much to do and it's so hard to be Krishna conscious. I don't have time to read and chant." In that situation, and Prabhupada wanted that so much. He saw that as a foundation for our movement. It's really important that this gets done. And Prabhupada said, just dedicate your life to Krishna. Lord Chaitanya will take you back to God and will take care of you. So there's that idea that's exemplified in the purport. You give yourself to the mission of the spiritual master. And then whatever is lacking, he makes up through his kripa, through his mercy. It doesn't mean you don't cultivate internally your spiritual life. But it doesn't mean you cultivate internally to a point where either you neglect the preaching, or you minimize it, or you give it a position. Or you think that you can't achieve a higher position unless you cultivate certain internal processes. So that's why that purport is juxtaposing. So this we know by Prabhupada's own example. When Prabhupada was ill and the devotees wanted him to rest, he said, "I'd rather die fighting on the battlefield." So he never set an example of giving up preaching. It was quite interesting. And what, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. You could say that was just his bhav, he couldn't stop preaching. Or you could say that was his example for us. Do the same thing. Or you can say both. And if it's the first, then it's the second also. Because he did everything as an acharya. So, outside of ISKCON, you'll get a little more of the other side. You know, preaching is like, it's like for neophytes. And you'll also get this other idea. You're not that advanced, so what can you preach? You don't have so much realization, how can you help people? I was preaching before I moved into the temple. That was the mood. And that's how we were trained. It's just, you know something, go out and give it. And by giving it, you get it. That was the training. It's in Prabhupada's books. You give Krishna, you get Krishna. So it's a different mood. You know, one is more internal. So every year, Prabhupada wanted us to go to Mayapur, to go internal, to get our strength for a month to go out and preach. That was the idea. He invited everyone, come to Mayapur. You've been on the battlefield, rejuvenate, recreate, get your strength. But his mood was to go out and give, and then you do your sadhana every morning, you get your strength. And then you give, and that giving will give you so much mercy, you become so dear to Krishna, that everything will be revealed. So that was his mood, definitely his mood. I mean, there's no question. I mean, that was always his mood. Don't neglect your spiritual life, but you give this life to Krishna, don't worry. And so his mood was almost like, even what does it matter if you see Krishna? You bring millions of people to Krishna. That's what matters. Don't let Krishna decide what he does with you, where he wants you to go. That was the idea. So he did give one devotee, Babaji, because that devotee thought he was going to die. But other than that, he never did it. Because Babaji is total retirement. Now, another interesting thing he did is he gave young men sannyas. And when later asked, "Didn't you know some of them would fall down?" He said, "Yes." He said, "But when you fight a battle, you need generals. And when you fight a battle, some of the generals are going to get shot. But you still make generals and you still send them out." And even after they got shot, he said, "That's okay. You can, you know, once you recuperate, come back in a different ashram." So that's kind of revolutionary, I think, that he was so willing to accept them and give them responsibilities, sometimes the same responsibilities they had as sannyasis. So it's, you know, it shows how important preaching was to Prabhupada, that he would do that. And so, you know, you were a sannyasi, you fell, okay, continue, no problem. Get married. It's no problem at all. He never made you feel guilty. He never made you feel like it was an impediment to your preaching. Preach, bring people to Krishna consciousness. That is the highest service. So that's definitely Prabhupada's move. And that's why we succeeded in spreading this movement in a few years, because of that move. Yes?
I feel like Huntley Brinkley here. just on that point of deputizing, you know, 20-year-olds. In fact, one of them came to South Africa, Rishi Kumar.
Yeah, Pushta Krishna.
Yeah, they were very young men. So I served for 4 years as the indexer for Prabhupada's books in Los Angeles, 76 to 80. And I remember when the seventh canto came down the pike, came down the tube from Prabhupada. Right at the end of the seventh canto, there was a real heavy purport. The key word was vantashi. It means one who eats his own vomit. And it was in the context of somebody who had taken sannyas, and then he leaves sannyas to again take up, you know, material life. And it's really heavy, you know, one who eats his own vomit. Okay, that ended the canto. That was right at the end of the canto. Eighth canto. Right in the beginning of the eighth canto, there's Gajendra Leela. Now Gajendra, if you remember, he's out of his element. He's fighting the crocodile for 1,000 celestial years. Ordinarily, an elephant can beat a crocodile any day of the week. But Gajendra was out of his element. He was in the river, and after 1,000 celestial years, he was weakening. And then he was just practically on the point of death, and he finally remembered Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So in that whole Leela, Prabhupada takes the opportunity of Gajendra's weakening to offer, so to speak, the olive branch. First he gave the thunder at the end of 7.3, you know. If you leave sannyas, this is like eating your own vomit. And then, during the Gajendra Leela, he says, so Gajendra, you know, he was getting weak. So if you're feeling weak in the sannyas ashram, then go to the Grihastha ashram. Don't give up the fight. Don't give up the fight. So he offered, you know, this. So again, you have to take Prabhupada, you know, forgive the cliche, holistically. Right? As much as Prabhupada emphasized preaching, it's a fact that if we're not in reaching, we can't outreach. And in NOI, Nectar of Instruction, the Dati Pratigrinati, the six loving exchanges, purport to that verse, Prabhupada says that the whole reason he created ISKCON was so people could engage in these six loving exchanges. Exchanging gifts, exchanging thoughts, exchanging prasada. And that's what really nourishes us. And that's what enables us to be inspired to go out and share Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, you know, how long can you run on empty, as the saying goes. Right? So, it's always, you know, back and forth. Here's Mayapur. Prabhupada is hosting in his rooms the Radha Damodar traveling Sankirtan parties, which they're the most successful troupe, you know, book distribution troupe, I think, to this day in ISKCON's history. You know, Kamal Krishna Maharaj especially was the organizer of that. He was the general behind that. So all of his buses, all of his men came. It was March 17th, 1976. And they're all in Prabhupada's room. You know what Prabhupada's talking about? The importance of cooperation. As he very often talked about, the importance of cooperation. And here's the extraordinary example Prabhupada used. Lord Chaitanya, Prabhupada said, he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he's saying, I have all these fruits to distribute. I can't do it alone. I need your help. He's begging our cooperation. And then Prabhupada said, just like you, you're out distributing my books all over the world. And then somehow I'm getting the credit for this. But what can I do? I'm an old man, but you're helping me. But Lord Chaitanya, he's God. And he's saying he needs our cooperation. And if you read that whole section in CC, it's all about how the more you distribute, the more you get. But it is true at the same time that it's the mood in which we distribute. It's the cooperative mood. It's the Vaishnava qualities that actually inspires people to read the books. Yeah, I want to know what this person has, you know, because he's so happy, he's so convinced, such a nice person. That's what really gives the potency when the devotees are manifesting. And that comes from the loving exchanges among devotees. If we don't have that, then you won't last long just distributing books or whatever outreach you're doing, just doing it mechanically, unless back home there's some real shelter. So Prabhupada emphasized both things, the inreach and the outreach, but the whole idea, as Mahaprabhu was suggesting, if you're receiving a lot of shelter and inspiration and mercy, you must distribute that. The French have a saying, noblesse oblige. It means, to whom much is given, the nobility, noblesse oblige. You're obliged to give it, to share it, and not hoard it. Don't be a creepina, or we say in America, don't be a creep. Don't be a creepina. You know, be liberal, distribute it. And the more you distribute it, then Krishna in the heart is so pleased, the more inspiration you get. So it's both. They're co-relative. You can't have one without the other. The inreach and the outreach. And you'll find abundant evidence for that in Prabhupada's books. Whereas, perhaps in another sangha, you might find a lot of inreach, but there isn't so much giving it. But the whole purpose of the inreach is to give it, is to outreach, is to bring as many people home and please Krishna as we can.
When you were giving that example of taking sannyas and then getting married, it's probably given the purport I was thinking. That is there any precedent for that in Vaishnavism that you would reinstate a sannyasi who's done something abominable?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's there in Bhagavad Gita. The precedent is there.
Mm.
But what I was thinking was that, you know, when Prabhupada started preaching, many people, smarta Brahmins, but even Gaudiya Vaishnavas, did not accept us as devotees. Because we were mlechas and yavanas, which means those born outside the Vedic culture. Not talking about us being Shudras, not being Brahmins. We're talking about out below Shudra, just outside that. And so some of Prabhupada's godbrothers didn't actually accept us as Vaishnavas. Based on some Shastra, something, I don't know. I don't know what their reference was. And then recently I read the website of a Brahmachari, who's a disciple of an ISKCON guru, who stated that Jiva Goswami said that if someone is a Malachari Yavana, they cannot become a guru. And he presented that to the GBC. The GBC rejected it, and then he left ISKCON. So you might be thinking, well, why would anyone believe that? Prabhupada trained us to be gurus. But I'm just making the point that when you become very black and white, orthodox, traditional, then what Prabhupada did may look wrong. And some of Prabhupada's disciples actually left him. But when you understand Prabhupada's heart was to incorporate everyone, to encourage everyone, to give everyone an opportunity to serve Krishna. And he had deep faith in the process and the holy name. So he knew that we all would be purified if we took to it. So he didn't see us as malechas or yavanas. He saw us as Vaishnavas. And later on, many of those who first doubted understood. By seeing the advancement of the devotees, they understood these are really Vaishnavas. And one of the things they noted was the deep level of devotion that we had for Prabhupada, which they said was unprecedented in their Gaudiya mission. They never saw such a deep level. And of course, that's really the essence, your Guru Nishtha, your Guru Seva. So we had that, and that's the most important thing, because Prabhupada said, they'll do anything for me. And then that's how you become dear to Krishna. So we may be Malachas, Yavanas, whatever. But Prabhupada never dealt with us that way. that his whole mission was spread by Malechas and Yadavas. It wasn't spread by Brahmins from India. So you could see Prabhupada's mood. Extended, and then exalt everyone, give them position. I was president, I was 8 months in the womb, and I was put in charge of one of his temples. That says a lot. That's the mission. Take these people, give them the holy name. If they follow the principles, they're Vaishnavas. And they can make other people Vaishnavas. So anything which furthered the preaching, Prabhupada would support. In any way he could engage people, no matter how fallen, he would engage them. And then at the end of the movement, when in Prabhupada's last days, the devotees felt that maybe they had let Prabhupada down in some way. He had to associate with them, which was an austerity. And Prabhupada said, no, you're all Vaishnavas. I enjoy your association. Though he didn't see it that way. But even some of his godbrothers saw it that way. And they were very learned, and still they saw that we're not qualified. It was interesting. So Prabhupada had to protect us a lot by telling them, by convincing them we are Vaishnavas. There was another time. This is really strange. This was an internal problem. And probably the seeds of this exist in some places still today. I may have told you this. In 1976, they passed a resolution. I don't know if you're going to understand this. I'll have to maybe give you some context. They passed a resolution. No, they didn't pass a resolution. Well, the GBC passed, but it had to be approved by Prabhupada, and he didn't approve of it. When you hear the resolution, you'll understand why. The GBC, how many GBC were in 1976? 12, 13, 15?
Yeah.
The leading devotees of the Hare Krishna movement passed a resolution that every unmarried woman will only be allowed to live in Australia.
Really?
Yeah.
You saw that in writing?
Yeah, Sachin Maharaj. He talks about it. He's the one who read it to Prabhupada.
I think a leper colony, huh? Australia.
Yeah, so the context was this Radha Damodar party. They're feeling, they had these brahmacharis, and just having women in the temple was just an obstacle. Of course, if there's women, then the men get married. If the father women in Australia, I don't know what they're going to do to the poor men in Australia. They're all going to marry 10 women or something. But
no worries, mate.
Yeah, they like that. Maybe that's why. So, but to show you, just to give you an idea how, because we're such young devotees and so uninformed and immature, that even as leaders we would pass a resolution like this. That's so crazy. And as I remember the story, as Sachin Maharaj was reading the resolutions, then when Prabhupada got to that one, he'd go down and said, okay. And he got to that one, and he just stopped. And Sacha Rupmarsh just said, Prabhupada, when he read it, he went, And so Prabhupada, we should, cross that, remove that, delete it. Prabhupada said, I do not want to deny anyone the opportunity to living in our temples. I want this for everybody. So you can really see Prabhupada's heart there. And how that heart overshadowed any kind of rule and regulation that some people would criticize us for not following. That was Prabhupada's mood. The mood of ISKCON was this huge heart for everybody to come. We had people in our temples that were a little crazy. A lot crazy, especially in the early days, because the youth were taking drugs and it was disrupting their minds. And the mood then was just unlimited patience for these people. And one story, one of our godbrothers, he'd taken so many drugs, it took him all day to chant his rounds. He was so, the word spaced out? Well, he was the incarnation of spaced out. He'd chant one or two mantras and he'd stop and look around. 30 seconds later, one or two mantras. So it actually took him the whole day to chant his rounds. And then they asked Prabhupada, should he live in the temple because he doesn't do any service? And Prabhupada said, it's okay. If that's all he can do, let him chant his rounds. So, you know, so in other words, Prabhupada wanted everyone. In that story we told in Mayapur about the brahmachari, he's in the congregation, he's visiting the temple, and one day comes the temple in a sari. I was there, so I saw this. It wasn't secondhand.
Mayapur.
In Berkeley. 1969 in Berkeley. Yeah. And he's coming and he's talking like a woman. He's wearing a sari, his head's covered. He was talking like this. Hari Prabhu. And then, you know, a few days later, he comes as a brahmachari, a few days later as a woman. You know, so you might think, okay, that's too much. Or just ask him not to come. And it's like, maybe in this life, you know, you're not meant to be a devotee. And so they wrote Prabhupada. Prabhupada just said, tell him to decide if he's a man or a woman and just stick to it. You know, just changing is not good. You know? I mean, you know, just think of that. You know, that's like, just like, let everybody come. It's okay. You can dress like a woman. Just don't change every day.
Pick one.
This changing business is not good. Yeah. You know. And you would think, you know, strict sannyasi would just set this person straight. What is this nonsense? You think you're a woman. So that was also our mood, that we would accept people in the temple. Not that I'm recommending that you know, sometimes you accept someone like that and everyone else in the temple leaves because they drive everybody crazy. So that wasn't the idea. But Prabhupada was very tolerant with these people. And he was, you know, he was dealing with hippies, and they didn't really have any qualification. But he saw some sincerity, and that was it. They were sincere, and that was important for him. So, I think that's important, because it's very much contradictory to an idea of very strict principles you have to follow, and previous samskaras, and so forth. And the fact that we were spreading Krishna consciousness was making Prabhupada happy. And he always honored us for that and encouraged us for that. And he never made us feel bad for being spaced out, drugged out, stupid idiots, basically. You know, didn't know anything. But these spaced out, drugged out hippies could go out and convince others spaced out drugged hippies to be devotees and open temples, and so he appreciated that.
Right? Open space stations.
So he didn't say, yeah, you're all worthless. You know, okay. So, I mean, in a sense, that was a qualification, because we knew how the spaced out people thought, because we thought the same way. So we could speak the same language. And I think Prabhupada understood that we were the right people. So he encouraged it, you know. Even to the point that when he was in America, he didn't get so involved, because he said, you're Americans, you know what to do. You didn't get that involved. Unless we deviated, he was just, yeah, do what you're doing is good. Now, there's another story you may have heard. There was a group of devotees, and they were gathering every day, and they were just reading the pastimes of Krishna with the gopis. And so some devotees became concerned. Make a long story short, they brought it to Prabhupada, and he stopped it. And he commented, he said, if I didn't stop it, it would ruin the preaching. Isn't that interesting? That was his main concern, was this would deviate you, and you would stop preaching, and you would just go internal to relish, to hear. And also think you don't need to preach and you're on some highly elevated platform. Whatever else would transpire, that would stop you from preaching. So he and Prabhupada saw a connection. That something had entered somewhere from outside of ISKCON that's getting these devotees to do something that Prabhupada never told them to do, that they conceived was the right thing to do because Gopi Bhava is the highest. So we should just hear about the gopis, although Prabhupada never said that. And Prabhupada's concluding that we'll destroy the preaching. can't even say it'll destroy your devotional service, or that implication might be there, but he never said it directly. That will destroy the preaching. So, you know, do you really get this idea that Prabhupada's service was to spread Krishna consciousness, and that's the real service? And if anything gets in the way of that, that's a huge problem, and that's not what Prabhupada wants. And a lot of, not a lot, but some things that filtered into the movement would have destroyed that mood and destroyed the preaching, and we would have started, you know, going off in caves and chanting 108 rounds a day and whatever, which would be good for us, of course, but not good for the rest of the world. And maybe in the long run, not good for us. We might end up with a bunch of 108 gopis also, one for each round or something. Because that also happens.
That was going on. When I arrived in Los Angeles in 76 to join the BBT, I was a brahmacharya. I was memorizing the Bhagavad Gita at the time. That sort of kept me together for... It was a six-year jugga. When Macmillan came out with the Unabridged Gita in 72, and I sat down on Prabhupada's Vyasa Puja Day in New Vrindavan and made a vrat. And then 6 years later, at the preliminary grand opening of Prabhupada's palace in New Vrindavan, I recited the whole thing. So in 76, let's see, I was about up to maybe chapter 12 or 13, you know? And not long after I arrived in L.A., I received an invitation from some senior BBT men to come join our evening reading, CC, Chaitanya Charitamrita. So I said, wow, that's interesting, because those books had just come out, and I hadn't read any of them, so I thought this might be nice. But as soon as I accepted the invitation and walked into the meeting, I knew something was strange, because right away, people were scorning and minimizing the value of Bhagavad Gita. My book, you know, it's memorized, my Gita, you know. Oh, it's just about the three modes, Prabhu, you know, it's very external. This is the real nectar.
Wait, can I make a comment?
Yeah.
And anybody says, this is the real nectar, that's a red flag.
It's a red flag.
This is not the first time this was said. It's been said, and it's still being said all the time. That's how you know. Walk the other way. Unless it's book distribution. That's another thing.
So I never went back. And sure enough, that was in January 76. Prabhupada came to town in June. And Prabhupada had heard some things. But then one morning, Prabhupada's just about to take breakfast. This is all, you can read it in Harishari Prabhu's diary. And all of a sudden, Prajunya, his Sanskrit editor, barged in Prabhupada's room where he has the first morsel of dried fruit and nuts in his hand. He's just about to take it. And Prajunya blurts out, Prabhupada, I just met the leader of the CC study group, and he was minimizing the value of the Bhagavad Gita. So that morsel of prasad never got to Prabhupada's mouth. He put it down in the dish, put his hand down on the desk and said, call all the leaders at once. Call all the visiting sannyasis, temple presidents. Call all the people in this group. We're going to settle this right now. And so, I wasn't in the room, but I had, right after it happened, I debriefed somebody that was in there, in the room. And he told me everything that happened. And you can also read it in the diary. So without any preliminaries, you know how Prabhupada starts the meeting? He looks at the people who are, you know, prematurely focusing on Gopi Bhav. And he just says to them, why are you jumping like monkeys? That's how he starts. But these people are so smitten, they're so intoxicated with their newfound Gopi Bhav, that they start arguing with Prabhupada. And they said, but Prabhupada, Lord Chaitanya said this is the topmost. And whatever they said, Prabhupada in his typical rhetorical jujitsu fashion, when you're using their words against them, he would just say, why don't you, Lord Chaitanya, yes, he said that, this is topmost. But are you topmost? Why don't you remember what else Lord Chaitanya said? My spiritual master found me to be a murkha, a great fool. not fit for doing anything but chanting Hare. I can't study Vedanta, you know, I have to just chant Hare Krishna. And then the next person said, I mean, they were still going, they kept pursuing Prabhupada. But Prabhupada, these are your books. We're not studying somebody else's books. These are your books. So Prabhupada, very practically bringing up something from his old family life days, said, my books are like a drugstore. Prabhupada was a pharmacist. He had his own pharmacy.